match it as my chairing assignment because I admire our presenter so much and I have been so highly entertained and educated by his books. Is the microphone all right? Good. Welcome, then, to session 140, the case for carping criticism, or Report from the Doghouse, by Samuel W. Taylor, who is sitting here beside his daughter, Sarah Weston. Sarah is going to read the majority of the paper. Samuel will make some introductory remarks and will answer, of course, questions. Sarah's background, PhD in educational psychology from BYU, lives with her husband and two children in Redwood City. I cannot figure out why I did not know this family while I was at Stanford. I am very sorry about that. She has counseled and taught in high school for 10 years in her area. So in a way, she's a mouthpiece this morning also for her father. Samuel Taylor began publishing while a student at BYU. I understand he's proud of having had 6 suspensions from that university. I'd call that 100%, wouldn't you? He's been a writer ever since. He was a war correspondent, cleared to nose in to anything and anywhere. Soon produced his first book, Fighters Up, about the fighter pilots in that war. He said he learned every market demands your best, but the better markets pay better and they treat you better. So, aim, of course, for the better markets. He has written short shorts, articles, books. Many of his books, several of his books, have been made into movies. You may be familiar with The Absent-Minded Professor. You may be familiar with Flubber. You may be familiar with The Man with My Face, that were all made into films. Much of his work has been based on Mormon culture, articles, stories, and books, including Nightfall at Nauvoo, which may be familiar to you. He has won an award for the best Mormon novel and the best Mormon biography. We want to hear from him, not from Carol Quist, and so I'm going to conclude by saying, an author does not write for his soul. These are his words. He writes for his public. He may have a perfectly lovely soul, but no one will give a damn. For many years, he had a most loyal and devoted public, consisting of a Midwest chicken farmer. Then the man died. This left Taylor as an author without a public, and hopes that someone here, or a member of the California Writers Club, will volunteer to fill this vital role. Responding to this paper tonight will be Ted Lyon. Ted was born in Salt Lake City. He's the son of T. Edgar Lyon, of historical fame. His expertise is Latin American studies, focusing on literature. Has published 3 books of his own, 2 about Latin American literature, 1 about John Lyon, the Mormon poet, and is currently working on a biography of his father, T. Edgar Lyon. As it happens, the family donated Dr. Lyon's papers to the church historical archives, library, whatever it is, and now is having difficulty getting access to their own papers that they donated. And I think this would be a case for carping criticism. He is most proud of his literacy project that he is superintending in Mexico. I think it will be a pleasure for all of us to hear from Samuel W. Taylor, from Sarah Weston, and from Ted Lyon this afternoon.
You don't know how wonderful it is to be here where east is east and west is west, and you can bank on it. It's not that way in California. The reason I built a house on Stockbridge Avenue in Redwood City is because that's the only place in the entire San Francisco Bay Area where the sun comes up in the east and sets in the west. Otherwise, you never know what that crazy sun will do. Now, I'm like a rat in a maze. I somehow get around, but don't ask me how. And the problem is, people do ask me. I take a walk in the afternoon, and cars are always pulling up asking directions of me. I was walking along Santa Clara, and this car pulled up, and the guy says, "How do I get to Jefferson?" Well, if I told him how I got to Jefferson, he'd never make it. So I said, "Me no speak English." And I was walking along the Alameda, and the car pulled over with a man and woman in it. And the man said, "What road is this?" I said, "Alameda de los Pulgas." The woman said, "Drive on, George, he doesn't speak English." And now, because of a temporary eye condition, my daughter, Sarah Weston, will read my paper.
I am sure that you are as aware as I am that no one can fill my father's shoes. But with your permission, I will stand in them for a few minutes. The case for carping criticism, report from the doghouse. Oh, what a star-spangled web we weave when with much practice we deceive. You won't find the state of Arnold on the U.S. map, nor is Arnold, D.C., the seat of government. Yet this might have been so if Benedict Arnold's plot for overthrowing the infant republic had succeeded. Had that happened, George Washington would be remembered as a traitor, the 4th of July wouldn't commemorate the Declaration of Independence, the Boston Tea Party would be an example of colonial hooliganism, and we'd know nothing of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. It isn't the playing of the game which counts, but who wins. The loser ends up in the doghouse. Looking back, I've wondered who was the greatest Mormon dissenter, the most outstanding carping critic of our history. Think of the former stalwarts who fell from grace: Sidney Rigdon, Frederick G. Williams, William Law, Amasa Lyman, and Albert Carrington, all members of the First Presidency. John C. Bennett, Assistant President. William Smith, Church Patriarch. Thomas B. Marsh, President of the 12. The Three Witnesses of the Book of Mormon. And others. The list could be a long one. And yet, the greatest dissenter of all wouldn't be on the list, for he didn't fall from grace. For dissent, for carping criticism, for flouting public opinion, for the greatest rebel against the established order in church history, I would nominate none other than Joseph Smith. One thing you can say about this teenager who, early in the 19th century puritanical America, affronted every established religion by declaring that none of them had the true doctrine and that all creeds were an abomination, was that he told it like it was. Of course, we know that he had this information from the very highest authority, but still, it was the last thing the world wanted to hear. he landed in the doghouse for sure. I can relate to this youngster of 14 who, even after the tremendous experience of the first vision, admitted that I was left to all kinds of temptations and mingling with all kinds of society. I frequently fell into many foolish errors and displayed the weakness of youth and the corruption of human nature, which I am sorry to say led me into diverse temptations to the gratification of many appetites offensive in the sight of God. Ah, yes, I also was a teenager with the temptations and appetites. Who hasn't been? It was to be 3 more years before Moroni took Joseph to view the golden plates. Certainly, he had matured in the meanwhile, had struggled with the corruptions of human nature, had achieved a measure of success. Yet it still took 4 more years before he had attained the stature of a prophet and was qualified to receive the plates. Jesus also awaited maturity before he began his ministry. Uneasy is the head that wears the crown, be it of precious metals and jewels, or the crown of spiritual leadership. Joseph had a rare talent for antagonizing people. He was shot at. He was tarred and feathered. He and his people were run out of Ohio and run out of various counties in Missouri. He was in Liberty Jail at the time Governor Boggs issued the order that the Mormon people must be expelled from the state or exterminated. Then, to cap it all, he restored the practice of plural marriage, which scandalized and affronted the nation and much of the world. It simply was inevitable that this rebel against the established order should end up a martyr. Yet Joseph had good precedent. The history of prophets is the history of martyrs. Jesus also had a talent for infuriating the establishment. He escorted the most sanctimonious and revered people of his time, the Sadducees, the scribes, and the Pharisees. He stepped on many toes with carping criticism and was continually in the doghouse. He pulled the wrath of his own people onto his head and ended up on the cross. America was founded by dissidents. The Puritans left Europe for a new land where they would have freedom of worship. There has been speculation as to where else in the world might Joseph Smith have been successful in founding the church. The spirit of carping criticism in the New World was such that Patrick Henry could proclaim, "Is life so dear and peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death." We are advised that obedience is the first law of the gospel. True enough, but obedience to what? "This above all," Shakespeare said, "to thine own self be true." Can we remain true to the kingdom of heaven within us if we are being asked to surrender our free agency through obedience? Shelley called obedience bane of all genius, virtue, freedom, truth, makes slaves of men, and of the human frame a mechanized automaton. Certainly, we can assume that those of superior church office act through inspiration and are guided in their decisions. Indeed, they are, up to a point. Yet when even Joseph Smith freely admitted that some of his revelations were of God, some of man, and some of the devil, are we to expect infallibility from lesser authority? Joseph said he sometimes spoke as a prophet and sometimes as a man. Must we believe this doesn't apply to authorities today? History tells us otherwise. The carping critic holds that mistakes can be made by others, just as he himself is guilty of whoppers. He agrees with Shelley's conviction that power, like a desolating pestilence, pollutes whatsoe'er it touches. And with Lord Acton's statement, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. How true it is that power never is voluntarily relinquished. Unrighteous domination never abdicates. It must be overthrown. Fortunately, in a land of freedom, this doesn't have to mean revolution. Carping criticism, whistleblowing, protest, and the ballot box are effective weapons. As one with a hard-earned reputation as resident gadfly and caustic curmudgeon of Redwood City First Ward, I must confess that my carping criticism has earned few, if any, brownie points from Salt Lake. However, there are perks and fringe benefits from other quarters. I can communicate with people with whom Salt Lake cannot. I can talk with the disenchanted, the dropouts, the fundamentalists, the inactive, people who no longer listen to Salt Lake. I can be friends with those in outer darkness, with those who have been cut off and delivered unto the buffetings of Satan. I can find rapport with people of firm testimony who, for various reasons, never darken the door of a chapel. I can appreciate the viewpoint of those who profess to disbelieve LDS doctrine, yet are at the same time fascinated with it and must research and discuss it with obsessive zeal. I can open doors which are closed to the self-righteous. And a fringe benefit is to bring back some of those who jeer at missionaries. A perk is to see bitterness mellow to understanding with people who have lost it and then have regained it. Matter of fact, I can talk to outcasts much easier than with zealots who have all the answers to the unanswerable. I have no communication at all with those who know, with absolute certainty, the answers to mysteries which we are asked to accept on faith. The self-righteous cast iron rotters speak a jargon I cannot understand. They are complacent in the conviction that their calling and election is assured. To me, that is the very best evidence that it isn't. On the positive side, we must admit that except for carping criticism, we would still be buying the counterfeit tales of Mark Hoffman. It was whistleblowing which brought him down. A little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Also a little authority held by little people. An inactive member who was a high school music teacher was asked to form a stake orchestra. He did so, and he worked with it until it was an excellent group. To get someone involved is, of course, a time-honored method of reactivation. So the end of this story should be that the man became ward bishop. What actually happened was that after the orchestra was ready to perform, the rug was jerked from under him. He was informed that a priesthood holder must be the director. I know this story is true because the man was my brother-in-law. Needless to say, he didn't end up bishop. He ended up bitter. An inactive woman member who had married a Gentile was the mother of two fine teenage sons when a zealot was appointed her home teacher. This man hectored her about getting the boys baptized and ordained to the priesthood. He became so obnoxious that the husband reminded him that he was a guest in the home and must either act as such or stay away. Whereupon the zealot stomped out and reappeared with a paper. He delivered an ultimatum, either get in or get out by signing the request for excommunication. I know this is true because the woman is my niece. When I wrote to Salt Lake asking if this was approved policy, the answer was that it definitely was not and that the bishop had been so advised. Of course, my personal popularity wasn't enhanced. the whistleblower ends up in the doghouse. In ancient times, the bearer of bad news had his feet chopped off and spent his remaining lifetime on his hands as a doorman. He who tilts at windmills always is unhorsed. A devout friend spent 3 years of research and considerable money preparing a book containing accounts of conversions as reported by the Church News. I was marginally involved by advising the correct form of the manuscript. Several times I'd ask him, "Do you have permission to use this material?" He brushed this off, "But all royalties will go to the missionary fund, and I am freely donating my work and expense." Well, when he sent his manuscript to Salt Lake, he received a caustic letter stating that the material was copyrighted and that he had no right to plagiarize it. He was warned that if he published it, he would be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. While I felt that the writer of that letter might have been a bit more gentle in his advice about copyright, such an attitude on my part is carping criticism. It is a credit to my friend that the experience didn't dash the dew of faith from his eyes. In fact, shortly afterwards, when he and his wife were called to a foreign mission, he was happy to accept. As senior citizens, they had prudently saved a nest egg for their golden years. On this mission, the cost would be more than $1,000 a month. "The Lord blessed me with this abundance," he said, "and now the Lord has asked it back." He was glad to make the repayment. When we received the priesthood manual, "Seek to Obtain My Word," I responded to its invitation to evaluate it with a letter offering my opinion as a professional author. What I have to say about this particular manual also applies to every one of them for the past two decades and more. The message is excellent. The artwork is fine. The subject matter couldn't be improved. However, from a professional standpoint, the execution, the manner of presentation and writing, is no more than mediocre. In the writing business, we say it isn't just what you say that counts, but how you say it. We also say, if you have a message, send it Western Union. In other words, you must touch the heart and enhance the spirit of the reader. If you don't, you might as well send it Western Union. I am speaking now of intangibles, perhaps difficult to define, but of vital importance to a professional writer. Style, pace, impact, presentation, contact with the kingdom of heaven within us. It is not enough in this league to state the most obvious sentiments in bromides, cliches, platitudes, exhortations, and proof texts. From a professional standpoint, this is literary pablum. I have not seen a lesson manual in decades which has presented the spiritual values with the beauty and impact of William James's Varieties of Religious Experience, a book used as a text at BYU when I attended in a course on the psychology of religion, nor one with the fire and singing inspiration of Parley Pratt's autobiography. Must I conclude that qualities which are most appreciated in great literature have absolutely no bearing in the preparation of a lesson manual? Believe me, I am not alone in my opinion. At the Sunstone West Symposium at Concord, California, 4 March 89, David H. Bailey gave a paper, "Mediocrity, Materialism, and Mormonism." He said that the manuals are filled with simplistic, mind-numbing lessons. And he asked, how often do perfectly intelligent and even college-educated Mormons sit through superficial, elementary church lessons without complaint? He suggests that if many of us are frustrated with the boring content of these lessons, why don't more of us accept the invitation to express our feelings to the LDS curriculum department, which I am doing. Another paper at the symposium was Gary Bergera's The New Mormon Anti-Intellectualism, which also might be a factor in the mediocrity of the manuals. I would like to compare the current manual with a really excellent one, Apostasy to Restoration by T. Edgar Lyon, The Course of Study for 1960. Here we have a man of vast erudition and superb skill presenting the message in a masterful manner. It is a joy to read. And in prior years, we had manuals by B.H. Roberts and other greats. My suggestion is that the preparation of the next manual be assigned to a qualified author, as was the custom decades ago. Certainly, we have excellent writers in the church. Give him the ball and let him run with it. Fortunately, our priesthood quorum has an excellent teacher, Dr. Clifford Curtis, who comes thoroughly prepared. He uses the lesson manual, of course, but amplifies and embellishes it, giving the lessons depth and immediacy. He commands rapt attention, sparking eager discussion, hitting home with a message. In contrast, when he is absent, as happened last Sunday, we get it straight from the book, and I am sorry to report it is strictly sleeping pills. In reply to the above love letter, I received a nice communique informing me that the brethren liked the manuals just as they were. This leaves me again unhorsed from the tilt at the windmill, licking my wounds in the doghouse. And I must wonder exactly why comments were invited if any changes were impossible. Was the invitation for praise only? One thing I might have mentioned was that literature never has been or will be written by a committee, as the manuals were, nor has a statue ever been erected to a committee. The inside cover of the Ensign, September 1989, contained the picture of a statue which stopped me short. It was the mortal Moroni, which stands close to the Manti Temple. Moroni has the golden plates under one arm, the other raised to the square. And so what's wrong with that? Well, the same thing is wrong with it that is wrong with other art concerning the golden plates, and also with written accounts of them being handled. What's wrong is that the weight of the gold is completely ignored. Back in 1857, a disenchanted ex-Mormon, John Hyde, Jr., published an extremely tedious book, Mormonism, Its Leaders and Designs, in which he calculated that the plates of gold measure 7 by 8 inches and 6 inches thick. Had these gold plates been tin, they would have weighed about 90 pounds. However, gold is much heavier than tin. Hence, this mass of gold plates, as they are not so compactly pressed as boxed tin, would have weighed nearly 200 pounds. The statue of the mortal Moroni has him carrying this extremely heavy load as if it were a box of soda crackers. Other artwork ignores the weight of the plates, as do written accounts. What does it matter if our artists and historians ignore the weight of the plates? It could matter a great deal to the 100%ers. It could shatter the faith of the cast iron rotters, whose belief is based on every single facet of their concept of things being true, or else nothing is. What damage would be done to such rigid faith by Hyde's statement that Joseph Smith carried, besides the plates, a breastplate of brass, Laban's sword, the crystal interpreters, the brass ball with spindles, director of Lehi? Yet he packs this horse load, keeps these large and awkwardly shaped things completely concealed, and at the same time beats off and outruns two empty-handed men a distance of 2 miles. 100%ers have stumbled over this. Stumbled over Senate Document 189. Stumbled over polygamy. Stumbled over the Smoot investigation. Stumbled over David Whitmer's An Address to All Believers in Christ. Stumbled over Mark Hoffman's forgeries. And various other obstacles in the straight and narrow path. An example is a man I knew rather well, Thomas Stewart Ferguson, who stumbled over the Book of Abraham. Ferguson, an attorney, was a red-hot zealot, 100%er if I ever saw one. He was involved in the Raft Lehi enterprise, a typical attempt to prove things we are asked to accept on faith. He had the faith and wanted to prove the world that it was true. To this end, he established the New World Archaeological Foundation, which, with the aid of church financial support, was, he claimed, finding absolute evidence of ancient Nephite artifacts in Central America. His book, One Fold and One Shepherd, advances the idea that Mesopotamians and Israelites crossed the Pacific Ocean between 5,000 and 2,500 years ago to settle in southern Mexico and Guatemala. A review in the Oakland Tribune stated, 1 January 1959. Ferguson said he used the Book of Mormon as a geographical guide to direct his crew of 11 archaeologists to a site in the Grijalva River where the digging was begun. Beneath fields of native corn, the team found remnants of some 50 cities. Among the artifacts excavated were cylinder seals, incense, and water vessels, and figurines containing inscriptions and carvings similar to the hieroglyphs and symbols of the ancient Near and Middle East. Using radiocarbon dating, Ferguson said he established the age of the artifacts at from 600 to 300 BC. Ferguson, 43, became interested in archaeology 20 years ago and did extensive reading in the field. He began his current fieldwork 6 years ago, setting out to prove, factually, the historical portion of the Book of Mormon. His zeal was such that he raised $250,000, primarily from the church, to finance the work. Tom Ferguson visited me soon after the book came out and presented me with a copy. He was lecturing at this time to general audiences, keeping everything strictly scientific, but with the purpose of proving the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. He wanted me to go to Central America to visit the activities of the New World Archaeological Foundation, to talk with the people involved, examine the evidence, and write an article for a national magazine, and also do a book for the outside world. It sounded interesting, I told him. I'd like to make the trip, and of course, go as the guest of the NWAF. Well, he said, it would be in the nature of a mission to prove the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. I'd have to pay my own expenses. Since I wrote for a living, taking a year off to research and write was another matter. I explained that it was customary for someone engaging a writer to work on a project to pay the expenses. He began to haggle, and finally he said he'd pay half of my plane fare. Well, why should I pick up the remainder of the tab for a purely speculative project? So I told him I was sure he could find another writer to do the job. However, we remained on good terms, and I arranged for him to give a lecture in my area. And then, 8 years later, on 27 November 1967, the Deseret News reported that a collection of papyrus manuscripts, long believed to have been destroyed in the Chicago fire of 1871, was presented to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints by the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Included in the papyri is a manuscript identified as the original document from which Joseph Smith had copied the drawing, which he called facsimile number 1, and published in the Book of Abraham. In Brigham Young University Studies, winter 1968, Dr. Hugh Nibley said, "This is a far more momentous transaction than might appear on the surface, for it brought back into play, for the first time since the angel Moroni took back the golden plates, a tangible link between the worlds. What we have here is more than a few routine scribblings of ill-trained scribes of long ago. At least one of these very documents was presented to the world by Joseph Smith as offering a brief and privileged insight into the strange world of the patriarchs." However, professors of Egyptology at University of Chicago and at Brown University declared the papyri were merely examples of the traditional Book of the Dead, a funeral document consigning the soul to the hereafter. Tom Ferguson was shaken by the controversy. He obtained copies of the papyri, and as Hugh Nibley published a series of articles in the Improvement Era defending the Book of Abraham and the papyri as the source of it, he clung to them month by month for support. At this time, my home teaching companion was Ferguson's son-in-law, so I had a running account of the agonizing problem. Doubt had entered Tom Ferguson's mind for the very first time, and it was a good mind. He was a lawyer. He was well-read on Mormon history. He had been a member of the FBI during World War II. Nibley's articles in the Era were beautifully written, making an impressive display of literary erudition, bolstered by voluminous footnotes. Yet as Ferguson studied the pyrotechnics of Nibley's articles, he was puzzled. Amid the rocket's red glare and the bombs bursting in air, Tom Ferguson failed to find authentic facts to support the splendid literary fireworks, and his faith wasn't still there. In fact, Ferguson suspected that it was all stonewalling. So he took the papyri to Egyptologists at the University of California at Berkeley. Their translation shattered him. In a letter to a friend, 13 March 1971, he said, "Nibley's articles on the Book of Abraham aren't worth a tinker. First, because he is not impartial, being the commissioned and paid defender of the faith. Second, because Professor Klaus Baer of the University of Chicago, Professor Lutz of UC Berkeley, Professor Lesko, UC Berkeley, and Egyptologist D.J. Nelson all agree that the original manuscript Egyptian text translates into the breathing permit of the Egyptian god Or. The breathing permit was a briefer version of the Book of the Dead." It was during this period that I last saw Tom Ferguson. He called around, and I won't forget him, sitting in my living room, his face ashen, his voice thin with venom, as he said, "Joseph Smith, how I hate that phony bastard." I couldn't help feeling sorry for the guy. The motivating force of his life for decades was completely shattered. Now he believed nothing. He didn't believe that Joseph or any other man had ever been in communication with the spirit world. If he'd had just a little of the aloof skepticism of the scientist, if he'd not been so completely sure of the mysteries, if the NWAF had sought evidence rather than confirming belief. It isn't a pretty sight to see a man spiritually adrift. Typical of the 100%er, it had to be all or nothing. And baby, with nothing, it's cold out there. As he previously had been obsessed with establishing proof of the Book of Mormon's authenticity, now Tom Ferguson devoted his considerable talents to proving it false. However, he retained his church membership and a degree of activity because of the faith of his family members and because, quote, "Mormonism is probably the best conceived myth fraternity to which one can belong," he rationalized. Why not say the right things and keep your membership in the great fraternity, enjoying the good things and discarding the ones you can't swallow and keeping your mouth shut? If only he'd had just a little of this attitude previously, as many of us have, to enable him to roll with the punches. "Belonging with my eyes wide open is actually fun," he admitted, "less expensive than formerly, and no strain at all." At the very time he called Joseph Smith that phony bastard, he had a son on a mission. Some 4 years later, in March 1975, Ferguson completed a paper refuting previous studies which claimed evidence of the Book of Mormon geography and Nephite artifacts. The paper also demolished his own evidence in One Fold and One Shepherd. At the conclusion of this 29-page study, he said, "I'm afraid that up to this point, I must agree with D. Green, who has told us that to date there is no Book of Mormon geography. I, for one, would be happy if D. were wrong." Tom died in 1983, age 67. Ironically, his son sponsored a posthumous revision of One Fold and One Shepherd, which was published in 1987 under the title The Messiah in Ancient America. A statement in the preface said, "With the recent additions by Dr. Bruce W. Warren, this book should reinstate Thomas Stewart Ferguson as a source of enrichment in the fields of study concerning Mesoamerica and the Book of Mormon." In 1988, the Tanners of the Utah Lighthouse Ministry issued a booklet, Ferguson's Manuscript Unveiled, price $3. In it, they document Ferguson's disenchantment by chapter and verse. He visited them, praising their dedication to demolishing Mormonism. He wrote letters to them, which are photographically reprinted. They quote his statement of 3 December 1979. "I lost faith in Joseph Smith as one having a pipeline to deity, and have decided there never had a pipeline to deity with any man." He had rejected God as well as Mormonism. He had become an atheist. Certainly, I can understand the desire of Ferguson's sons to present their father as one who died in the faith. But I cannot understand how apologists have reprinted a book which the author himself had utterly demolished in a paper of 29 pages. To a carping critic, this sort of thing is extremely dangerous. It suggests that people who should and do know better have deliberately presented repudiating evidence as proof of the Book of Mormon's authenticity. As for Tom Ferguson, He fits William Congreve's observation that heaven has no rage like love to hatred turned. And the second line, nor hell a fury like a woman scorned, could apply to a carping critic scorned. Thank you.
I'm honored to be briefly part of the same symposium that features Sam Taylor. Sam doesn't remember this, but he and I met on the desert down on Warm Creek or Last Chance Creek in 1955, and I'm featured in one of his books called Uranium Fever. He and his brother Raymond did this, and I happened to be a young teenager with O.C. Tanner's son playing around, working on the desert at the time. So we'd met before, and I'm honored to be part of him, and as well with Carol Quist, her son is married to my niece. That's just good old Mormon linkage. You know what we do? We want to feel part of the community. We've somehow known each other for a considerable period of time. I'm grateful for this chance to respond to the paper. I'll try to be very brief and ask you to think of questions that you may want to direct to me, but hopefully to the presenter. My first thought is a question to myself. Does anyone really like carp? Hardly anyone of my acquaintance here in this mountain retreat thinks very well of carp. Maybe back east, perhaps, you know, those strange people back there in New York, or maybe even the repressive regime in China. But no, not here, not carp. Carp are scaly, they're cantankerous, they're big, ugly, slow-moving, and to the fly-casting trout fishermen, they're just a big nuisance. They often get snagged by unwanting fishermen. They feed off the bottom, junk stuff, the dredges, anything that falls in the water. Their mouths point downward, never upward. And that's obviously symbolic. No one I ever know really loves carp, and certainly not the carpers, those who fish for them or those who do carping and complaining. So maybe a more positive image. What about a snipe or about sniping, as long as we're sticking with animals? No, those are non-game birds which bob up and down at the water's edge, and they're rather frivolous birds, skittish, unfriendly. But then there's the mythical snipe that belonged to all Boy Scout troops. That is, the hoodwink, the invisible furry thing that allows us to deceive the uninitiated. No, and that's not a very good positive image either. Continuing along with the animals, I thought, well, maybe we could talk about nags or nagging, which, of course, is nothing like a thoroughbred either. It's a slow-moving, sway-backed, worn-out, and basically useless animal. No, there just aren't many positive images when we start off with carping and go to sniping and nagging. So what is the good of carping? And the joy of this paper is that it's hit at a basic point of Mormonism, of this symposium. Does it make sense for us to get together and carp and complain and be featured as we were on the news this morning as the bereft Mormon intellectuals, what was one of the terms that I heard, who are gathering in Salt Lake today? I'm going to try to be serious, which is a little contrary to my nature for a moment, and just talk briefly about the paper. It really does touch this core of what is the good of carping, and as we look at the concern with Thomas Ferguson, here is a man who accepted everything and accepted it so deeply that somehow, according to Sam, that helped him get out of the church. I find a few weaknesses in the paper, and I shouldn't say this, but because somehow it's going to be like some strange literary critic standing up here and criticizing a man who is much smarter and much more experienced than I, but just let me mention a few things. The paper is a little weak in definition, I find. Perhaps I'm carping here myself on the need for definition of terms as we talk about them. I find the paper a little weak on lumping things together. And I hope you don't have a gun in that cane, Sam, or anything like that, but I have to say it. Sidney Rigdon, John C. Bennett, Joseph Smith, and Jesus Christ are lumped together as if they were all carpers of the same type. I don't think that's right. I think there needs to be some other categories of carpers. Christ himself would certainly carped against or complained against a Jewish tradition, but also postulated some other things, and I can't see him in the same category as John C. Bennett. Some of the comparisons are too easy as you go through the thing. I'd wished in a couple of cases you'd cited your sources rather than just paraphrasing Joseph Smith, because I felt that it might have changed it just a little bit. I think maybe your paper wandered a little bit, but geez, I'm wandering up here too. We all do that when we get up and speak or write, so maybe I can't be too critical of that. I wish the paper weren't quite as anecdotal, but I'm going to probably end up being somewhat anecdotal as well, so maybe I can't complain about that. I would have preferred your ending give me a little more conclusion rather than just ending or petering out. Anyway, but I enjoyed the paper. It's excellent writing. I've reviewed, sorry for all of those things that I said, but I had to say. I've reviewed a couple of Sam's books on different occasions and felt great delight in the joyful writing that he does carry out. I appreciate your humor, Sam. I've always known that we had iron rodders in the church, but I was unaware that they were cast iron rodders. And I think that's an excellent metaphor that we've come up with. And so I was wondering what we would say on the other side, because maybe some of us here are lighthearted or lost Leahonas if we want to continue using that dichotomy. I appreciate that humor. I have to share with you my very honest appraisal and opinion of the priesthood manuals. I sustain you 100%. All in favor, please raise your hands and say the same thing. I believe that the... I see a frown back there when I said that. Anyway, I'm afraid that some people have... No, it was just Lavelle Edwards. Anyway, I'm afraid that some people, though, don't feel that way. I served for some years writing the Family Home Evening Manuals of the church back in the days when there was some creativity in the manual. Toward the end of my tenure, I was asked for 1 year to work on the Melchizedek Priesthood Committee and did become part of that writing experience. The manuals are now written by computer. We are given a topic ahead of time. We punch into the computer, and this was back in the early days, the late 70s, the computer, the topic we want. We get quotes from the scriptures and quotes from recent general authorities, and the lesson is entirely that there is no room for creativity, and that's the way your manuals are continuously created at the present time. And the same thing takes place for Relief Society manuals, which are created by a committee which has men on it. Now, I'm carping, and I'm going to be in trouble, but I'm repeating simply what my own experience has been with these manuals. I enjoy your Ferguson anecdote very much. It reminds me of my favorite author, Jorge Luis Borges. Borges has a story which tells me of a man who affirms something so strongly that at the end of the period of his life, he ends up repudiating everything that he said during the previous 40 years. And this is a delightful story, and it's just one of those stories that antecedes, in this case, the story of the life of Tom Ferguson. But anyway, those are some personal reactions to it. Now let's get back to the main question, and I must be brief here. Let's assume that our definition of carping and carping criticism means that of complaining. That of complaining from a viewpoint where we want some change to be made. The carping isn't made just to undermine, but to encourage some change. What good does that really do? What good has it done in the past? We have some examples. I'm risking a little bit in being here. If you noticed my thing, it said BYU on it, and some of you are aware of that conflict. I probably shouldn't be here. I hope there are no tape recorders, and if there aren't, then I could deny everything that I may say. But we have been asked to be very careful. But risk is necessary for me and for you and for all of us to make any change. There really is a need to have a better priesthood manual. I admire your suggestions and like that in. I'm pleased that you, without knowing who was going to criticize your paper, mentioned my father's priesthood manual as one which was used in 1960 and held it up as a model. There's a need to return to that, not only in priesthood manuals, but in many other cases. Some of us experienced a wonderful youth program. Are your children or your grandchildren experiencing that same wonderful youth program right now? No, I don't think so, maybe in a few words, but it's not working right now. There's a need for people to hear that. Let's be trite and say a need for constructive criticism. No, I wish I could find a better way of saying that. There is a need somehow for a balance to take place. For the last 27 years, I've been a registered scouter. For at least 26 of those years, I have not enjoyed the scouting program, and let it be known. And again, I'm a heretic, and I can probably be shot at by several of you silver beavers down there. But but the reality is, it doesn't serve the needs of the young men with whom I have the privilege of working. It serves a few of their needs, and it serves the needs of most of the boys partially. But there are a few boys that it doesn't touch at all. And it doesn't give me any drama, it doesn't give me any art, it doesn't give me any organized sports, it doesn't give me any relationship with the opposite sex. Those I have to tack on. In that last point, relationship with the opposite sex, I mean healthy relationship, you know what I'm talking about. At any rate, the point is, there is a need for change, but there are internal pressures. I happen to know there are some general authorities who really want to make that change, and there are some others who have indeed been awarded silver and gold and bronze arrows and beavers and moose and everything else from the Boy Scouts of America that put that internal pressure that keep those changes from taking place. What is then the proper function of this meeting, of this paper, and of what we can do to be of assistance to the church? The paper has been presented in that light, that there is a true church, there is a faith, and there is a need to assist that church by carping criticism. I can only say that the need has to be to find a balance that will allow some criticism of programs, criticism of principles, criticism of activities, without undermining and destroying the base. And I think I'm agreeing with the tone of Sam's paper, who is not looking for the base to be destroyed, but rather to establish a firmer base by being able to criticize. Any organization that we belong to needs the criticism of people within its organization. On one occasion at the University of Utah, I asked Lowell Binion, knowing all these problems, why do you stay in the church? Why don't you get out? And he says, oh no, I can do so much more from within. And as you know, did. In 1958, he had a visit with President McKay and discussed with him the concept of the blacks and the priesthood. It didn't come about at that period of time. It was 58 or 59, somewhere in that date. It didn't come about at that time, but it did 20 years later. And it did because someone risked a bit, carped, if you will, a little bit, in a positive approach, and got something done as a result of it. It's that type of carping to the right sources that I think is the healthy one, and I believe the one that Sam recommends. Not only healthy for the church, but healthy for us. I conclude with a brief story. In anecdote, as I said. In a class that we've taught this summer at Brigham Young University to freshmen who think they're super intelligent, who decided to come early during the summer term to Brigham Young University, and they really are some very, very sharp students. We read several novels, criticism, we read chemistry, The Woolly Masters, and a whole bunch of other things. The final book they read was called Refuge, written by a Mormon writer, Terry Tempest Williams. Part of the course had been to get them to accept diversity, to see conflict, be able to handle diversity. About half of the students, as we read the class, could not handle the work. This, I can't call it a novel, but this personal essay, this unnatural history, as she calls it. They couldn't handle the work because the criticism was too close to home. And there were only a few critical lines. I hadn't noticed them when I assigned the book. But one of the girls asked, why does the BYU bookstore sell this book? And I said, would you suggest censorship? Oh, she says, oh, no, I wouldn't suggest censorship. But why do they sell the book? and there was a little lapse in reasoning in the point right there. But when the criticism comes too close to home, it became too painful. They'd read Rigoberta Menchú, this wonderful testimonial literature of Guatemala, and could recognize the terrific tensions and regimes. But when it came close to home, about half of the class was unable to recognize that. That's one of the difficulties with carping criticism. We may get ourselves in trouble without changing the model or changing what we're trying to do. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to our presenter, our respondent, our presenters, our respondents.
Yeah, give me a question.
2 minutes. Questions? Well, I'm just saying. Let's hear what you have to say. I'll be glad to repeat your questions into the microphone. Or you can come up. You may come up.
I love your book, Heaven Knows Why. It's still in print. So many people I want to have read it, but I can't find
it. It's sold in the BYU bookstore, they say. Try Benchmark Books, too.
I have hopes
of it coming back before too long.
Heaven Knows Why is out of print.
Heaven Knows Why it's out of print.
And he hopes, however, it will be reprinted soon. Other questions? Answers, and we will think up the questions. Yes, please. Comment was made about the word criticism in opposition to words such as feedback, suggestions, finding out how something works from the people on whom it is being worked. Am I representing your statement reasonably? Good. Rebuttals? Recross? Redirect? Thank you all for coming. I hope you enjoyed the rest of your sessions.